This is Radio Health Journal, a weekly news magazine with the latest in health, medicine, and technology. I'm Shel Lustig.
I'm Nancy Benson.
And I'm Reed Pence. This week, why being selfish is sometimes the healthiest option.
We're kind of taught to always help others and never to think about yourself. And I think that's terrible advice.
Then getting stuck in a crowd is more dangerous than you may think.
The density of the crowd gets so high that you can't inhale, you can't take a breath. And so the casualties and crushes are often by asphyxiation because people just can't breathe.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
You've got advanced prostate cancer, but you're not waiting around. You want your straight talk, the facts about Orgovyx.
Orgovyx relugolix 120 milligram prescription tablets is a treatment for adults with advanced prostate cancer. Fact, Orgovyx is a different kind of androgen deprivation therapy treatment, a pill, not an injection. Orgovyx may cause serious side effects, including a heart condition called QT prolongation. Tell your doctor right away if you feel dizzy, faint, have a racing or pounding heart, or chest pain. Orgovyx can cause harm to an unborn baby or miscarriage. Use birth control during treatment and for 2 weeks after Orgovyx treatment. The most common side effects include hot flushes, increased blood sugar and blood fat levels, muscle and joint pain, decreased blood hemoglobin levels, increased liver enzymes, tiredness, constipation, and diarrhea. Other side effects include weight gain, decreased sex drive, and erectile function problems. Orgovyx may cause infertility. Talk to your doctor if infertility is a concern for you.
Go with Orgovyx. Ask your doctor. For more facts, visit gowiththefacts.com.
We're taught from a young age to share our toys and not be selfish. As we mature, we learn that being kind means putting the needs of others before ourselves. But is kindness always the right answer, or can selfishness sometimes be the healthiest option?
The connotation of the word selfishness is that it's just inherently bad, like we shouldn't be selfish. We're kind of taught to always help others and never to think about yourself. And I think that's terrible advice.
That's Dr. Scott Kaufman, a psychologist, associate professor at Columbia University, and host of the Psychology Podcast. He says that while many of us consider selfishness to always be a negative trait, there are forms of healthy selfishness. And just as we can't automatically assume all acts of self-interest are inherently bad, Kaufman says not all acts of kindness are inherently good.
We can really help people in an intrusive way, in a way that is not really helping them in the way that they really need. In a lot of ways, it's helping our own ego. You can think of the narcissist who is just constantly bragging about how many people they've helped. And it kind of you get a flavor that it's like not really coming from a real genuine, like you're happy you're helping them. You're happy that helping them is helping your ego.
This idea is called pathological altruism, when helping others results in unanticipated harm. In an effort to differentiate between healthy selfishness and pathological altruism, Kaufman began his research, now published in Frontiers in Psychology. He first created a list of motivations of why people decide to help others.
Such as, I generally like to see people learn and grow. I generally love helping others and kind of in a way that's outside of oneself. And then I had a whole bunch of questions that were things like, I like helping people because it makes me feel good about myself. I need to be needed.
Ideas that may be self-centered in nature, but still provide an act of service for others, which is what Kaufman defines as healthy selfishness. Through his research, Kaufman found that these motives related the closest to those of genuine kindness, while the pathological altruistic intentions landed on the unhealthy side of the scale.
And that's very paradoxical. That finding is paradoxical because that's not what we're taught. We're taught that any action that looks altruistic is genuine, and anyone that's like any action that appears to be solely for yourself is not altruistic. And we found that's really flipped it on its head. Some evolution psychologists make the case that everything from a genes perspective is selfish. So everything that looks like helping others is selfish, really for our own gene propagation of either survival or reproduction. And I think that's too much of a reductionist view.
But how can we differentiate between healthy and unhealthy selfishness?
For unhealthy selfishness, we kind of operationalize that or define that as a motivation to exploit others for your selfish gain. And we contrasted that with this new scale of healthy selfishness, because I wanted to show there are different things. They're very different. They both predict very different things. It's like two completely different people.
In fact, Kaufman says that people whose motivations tend to skew toward unhealthy selfishness aren't actually very good at taking care of themselves. Another way to look at healthy selfishness is to think of setting boundaries. While this act of creating distance from people or habits can seem self-serving, Dr. Peter Loper says it's quite the opposite.
I think that one of the most powerful forms of compassion that any human can provide for another is setting limits. And so we do it with our kids all the time. You know, setting firm boundaries with our children is very, very important to support them in the adaptation of more healthy means of relating to other people. And so this idea of healthy selfishness and setting boundaries, for me, I believe it's one of the highest forms of compassion. If you set boundaries with somebody who isn't relating to you in a healthy way, it can really, really support that individual in developing the adaptation or adapting in a manner that helps them support them to relate to people in a more meaningful way moving forward.
Loper is an assistant professor of pediatrics and psychology at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine. He says that our relationships can be an incredibly powerful factor in our personal growth.
The rate limiting step to healthy human development and adaptation is healthy, meaningful interpersonal interactions. It's really when those relationships become unhealthy that they really start to have a negative impact on our development and our adaptation, our health, our well-being.
Which is why setting boundaries is so important.
The healthiest relationships are going to really reinforce this construct of reciprocity, whereby I'm equally gaining something from you by interacting with you and caring for you and vice versa. But oftentimes that concept of reciprocity is really skewed or altered, whereby one person is doing all the work.
And though placing limitations on a relationship can look like the beginning of the end, Loper says boundaries can actually help strengthen and grow that connection.
What you're doing with setting those boundaries is you're creating a noxious stimuli. And what happens with not human beings develop in the context of distress? It's adversity and distress. If we're not experiencing adversity or distress, we're not developing. So what you're doing is you're creating some adversity and some distress in the relationship by setting that boundary. Thereby, you're supporting the adaptive problem solving of the person you're relating to and your own adaptive problem solving. So collectively, you're able to develop and adapt a more healthy, meaningful relationship and engage that relational process, that the development of that relationship in what would be deemed transformational change.
Meaning that both parties learn how to interact in a healthier way. Being able to set boundaries is the first question on Kaufman's healthy selfishness scale. The other topics also revolve around self-care, which is most often achieved by prioritizing your life. Loper says when we become overwhelmed with the needs of others, the boundaries being crossed are usually violations of our time and emotions.
We oftentimes are externally oriented. We're really focused on our external environment, but we are really creatures that are informed by our internal experience. And so if you're in a relationship whereby you're constantly feeling uncomfortable, distressed, negative in terms of those interactions with that other individual, and you're having those feelings, that internal experience of what would be deemed quote unquote negative emotions with consistency and engaging with this individual, that would be a red flag that perhaps there is the need for some boundary setting.
Unfortunately, setting boundaries has only gotten more difficult with the rise of technology. The digital era has created the illusion that we have an all-access pass to talk to anyone at any time.
I'm sitting here having my phone on silent because if I don't, I'm going to get an email, I'm going to get a text message, you know, somebody's going to call me. And so the fact that we are accessible constantly throughout the course of our day really sets us up for, you know, puts us at risk for these boundary violations as it relates to our time.
For many people, these issues only grow as family and friends get together during the holidays.
One of the things that we see very often during the holidays is going to be situations whereby there may be a family member who is oftentimes feeling very lonely and very isolated, but is perhaps lonely and isolated by virtue of their inability to relate to other people in a healthy, meaningful way. And what happens oftentimes is that you have family members who are so giving, and they want to be caring and empathetic, and they want to be supportive.
But Loper says the supportive person is often taken advantage of, continuing to give until there's nothing left for themselves. He believes that healthy relationships require each individual to first take care of their own needs before focusing on others.
It's the same rule in the airplane. You put your own oxygen mask on first. And I think we oftentimes lose sight of that, right? We're scrambling, trying to put everybody else's oxygen mask on. And at the end of the day, we're just absolutely exhausted. So those are some circumstances that would really illustrate some potential for setting firm limits and engaging with people to make sure that they're aware that your time is of value and also your emotional energy is of value.
Whether it's with a family member, friend, or a coworker, setting boundaries can be uncomfortable. Loper says the best approach is to always be direct.
Be kind and be honest. And if they truly care about you, and if they're somebody worth having in your life, then they're going to acknowledge that. They may defend initially, they may trigger, they may act out, they may, you know, get upset or offended. But if you give them space then to be able to process those feelings, if it's a relationship worth having, they'll come back to you and they'll apologize, they'll engage with you in a meaningful way. And that's how you are able to reset that standard of reciprocity, right? We're back now to a give and take, two-directional, bi-directional relationship.
And if at first the other party refuses to respect your boundaries, Loper says consistency is key. You have to become comfortable with the word no.
If after being direct and being honest and being kind in terms of your engagement and explanation of why you're setting these boundaries and what those boundaries are going to need to be, if those boundaries are not respected and there's consistent boundary violations, then one of the most compassionate things you can do for yourself, but also bidirectionally for that other person, is to say no. And at the end of the day, that may be what you're left with is consistency in saying no.
Loper says one of the best strategies to stay strong and consistent is to cling to your personal values.
What are the things that are of most value to you? Is it time spent together with your core family? Is it time spent together with your core family plus, you know, your in-laws or whatever the case may be? But have a clear sense of what those values are so that you can be consistent, not just in saying no in times of boundary violation, but in terms of saying yes to other opportunities whereby you may be able to engage in a meaningful way with those values and adhering to those values.
Without a solid foundation of beliefs, it can be easier for societal pressures to influence your decisions. Kaufman says that trying to live up to the expectations of our peers often gets in the way of our own mental health.
Within certain communities, within certain political groups and everything, you sort of feel like the only extent to which you have value is the extent to which you're propagating someone else's political goals, that you can forget to advocate for your own needs as an individual, not as a member of a group, but as an individual. You know, your individuality matters. And I think we can forget that sometimes when we get too caught up in a larger group.
And boundaries aren't always because someone else is crossing a line. Maybe you've recognized some personal habits that no longer serve your life or relationships. Kaufman believes confronting those thoughts head on is the best path for personal growth.
There's great benefit to being really brutally honest with yourself. And that's why in my book Transcend, I have like lots of questionnaires, including like narcissism questionnaires. And, you know, like my publisher's like, that's not very uplifting, but I don't do it in a way that I want to shame people. Actually, quite the opposite. I think shame is a really unnecessary emotion in our human. If there's one emotion in the whole human gene pool that I'd be happy to take away, that'd be a shame, because it's not productive. Instead, self-insight is a great route to change and growth.
You can find more information about Drs. Scott Kaufman and Peter Loper on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. I'm Reed Pence.
Coming up, people are dying each year due to the phenomenon called crowd surges when Radio Health Journal returns.
Mornings were made for better things than rheumatoid arthritis or RA. Xeljanz tofacitinib is a pill for adults with moderate to severe RA when tumor necrosis factor blockers did not work well or could not be tolerated. Xeljanz can help relieve joint pain, swelling, and help stop further joint damage. Xeljanz can lower your ability to fight infections. Don't start if you have one. Before and during treatment, your doctor should check for infections like TB and do blood tests. Serious, sometimes fatal infections, cancers including lymphoma and lung, blood clots, serious heart-related events, tears in the stomach or intestines, and allergic reactions have happened. People 50 and older with heart disease risk factors have an increased risk of death. Tell your doctor if you've had hepatitis B or C, have flu-like symptoms, are prone to infections, or have ever had a heart attack, stroke, clot, or other heart problems, or swelling of lips, tongue, throat, or hives. Ask your doctor about prescription Xeljanz. Visit Xeljanz.com or call 1-844-XELJANZ.
Whether you're trekking through Disneyland or packed into a stadium dancing to your favorite band, it's easy to get lost in a crowd. Being bounced around in such a chaotic environment can be exciting, but crowds can pose a major safety risk that not many people realize. In order to better understand the potential threats, crowd dynamic research has become a growing field, where researchers like Dr. William H. Warren study the behaviors of large groups.
I try to develop models of how an individual reacts to other people around them, And we do that using virtual reality. So we take a participant and put them in a virtual crowd where they can walk around in a large lab space about 40 by 50 feet. And we can measure their behavior as they're interacting with this crowd. So we can manipulate the virtual crowd in order to see how people respond, you know, when they're trying to follow a crowd or when they're trying to weave their way through a crowd.
Warren is a Chancellor's Professor of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University. He says that at a base level, there's two types of crowd interactions.
So there's the regime when you can move freely and your interactions with other people are pretty much guided by vision. Like you can see how other people are moving. You have time and space to respond to how they're moving. And that's normally how we're like walking down a street or trying to cut through a sidewalk where people are moving in a different direction. And then the other regime is when people get packed so close together that it's physical contact, right, rather than sensory contact that's guiding their movements. And that's when you start to get things happen to people that are not under their control. They get caught up in these crowd motions.
Whether you're stuck in the middle of a stagnant crowd or able to move with the flow of the group, both of these dynamics present their own dangers. The first phenomenon is known as a stampede, when a large group of people rush to get to the same destination.
So there's enough freedom of movement so that people can begin to move quickly. And the problem with stampedes is that then often people trip and fall, right? And so you get people in the crowd start to fall, other people fall over them, and you start to get piling up of bodies where the people behind you can't see what's happening. So they keep coming, right? And so it just builds.
The second threat is called a crowd surge, sometimes known as a crush.
And that happens when people are pressed up against, you know, like the gate at a stadium or the entrance to a concert, and they haven't opened the gate yet, and people behind are pushing to try to get in, and the people in front are getting squeezed up against the gate or the doors of the venue. And so then the physical contact begins to get tighter and tighter, the forces get higher and higher, and people lose the ability to breathe, right? So the density of the crowd gets so high that you can't inhale, you can't take a breath. And so the casualties and crushes are often by asphyxiation because people just can't breathe.
The most recent example of a crowd surge occurred in Itaewon, South Korea. More than 150 people died during a Halloween celebration. Large crowds got stuck in alleyways, which created a crush. And even though there was little movement, many people were also trampled. Unfortunately, Warren says these events happen every year, though not all have as large of an impact as the South Korea incident. Places like clubs and concerts are prime venues for crowd surges and stampedes, despite authorities' best efforts to reduce the risks.
So you can plan for some of those, like large concerts or outdoor stadiums, mass events, but it's these sorts of, the Halloween gathering wasn't like a planned event with somebody organizing it. And I think the police just failed to anticipate, or the authorities failed to anticipate what the sizes, the numbers of people were going to be like. In previous events in Itaewon, they've had police or guards controlling the entrances to these little alleys, which is where the worst crushes happened. And they just were pretty much absent, as far as I could tell.
Around 100,000 people from all over the world attended the Halloween event, waiting to get into bars and clubs. Warren says the streets and alleyways were simply too small to accommodate such a large crowd.
So part of what was happening was that there's a subway entrance or subway exit right on Itaewon Street. And so that many people were arriving from this metro station, right? Then just right into the middle of this large, dense crowd. And so the density just kept going up and up. The alley that had the worst casualties was actually on a hill. So there, the two main streets are connected by these little alleys, and the alleys are actually on a hill. So Seoul is pretty hilly. And so not only that, but the alley with the worst casualties was wide at the top. It was about 7 meters wide, and it was about 3.5 meters wide at the bottom. So it acted like a funnel.
So as people began to go through the narrow alley, they got pressed closer and closer together. Sadly, no one seemed to recognize the threat until it was too late.
People were there to have a good time. There were reports of people shouting to push so that they could get through, which of course just exacerbated the situation. The other thing was that there was a lot of loud music. So there were a lot of bars and clubs that were blasting music onto the street. So there was very little communication. It was very hard for anybody to understand what was going on just 10 feet away from them. And so people entering the alley, had no idea what was happening at the bottom of the alley, and just kept pushing into the funnel. It just, things kept getting worse and worse.
Which is why crowd dynamic research is becoming a more popular field. Scientists are continuing to develop strategies that can keep everyone safe, no matter how large of a group they're in.
For events like the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, which is one of the largest mass events in the world, there are people who do studies with crowd simulations to try to anticipate where the jams are going to be, the bottlenecks are going to be, and how to keep the pedestrian flow moving. So there's a whole kind of infrastructure around crowd management and crowd control so that you don't end up with this sort of situation.
But no strategy is 100% foolproof, and accidents still happen. Warren says being proactive is the best option, which means not getting sucked into large groups in the first place.
The problem with the masses of people in Itaewon was it wasn't just that alley. The two main streets on either side of it were very full. There were several alleys which had casualties. And so the crowd just got so big and so dense in so many places that it became really hard for people to move.
However, if you do find yourself in the middle of a crowd, find the closest exit.
The CDC recommends that you don't resist the flow of the crowd. Try to go with the flow of the crowd. Try to remain standing, right, instead of falling. And if you do happen to fall, they recommend curling into a ball rather than falling flat, because that's going to kind of help prevent getting trampled and asphyxiated on the ground.
Warren says moving diagonally through the crowd is your best option to quickly make it out safe.
But in a crush situation like that, where you're pushed up against a gate or a fence, you just have to kind of try to work your way back out from the middle of the crowd if you have any opportunities to do that. But I think the main thing is don't get into that situation to begin with. Anticipate that these things can happen, and don't be the first in line, you know, at the gate when there are thousands of people piling up behind you.
You can find more information about Dr. William Warren and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Nancy Benson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment. This week is National Influenza Vaccination Week. The American College of Physicians, a national organization of internal medicine physicians, urges adults to get an annual influenza vaccine. It's also a good time to ask about other recommended vaccinations, including COVID vaccines. ACP President Dr. Ryan Meyer states, immunizations guard against serious health problems, hospitalization, and even death. They also help prevent the spread of disease, especially among those most vulnerable to complications. Find out more at acponline.org.
I wanted to know why some people who get COVID-19 get it so bad. I found out it may be because they have a high risk factor, such as heart disease, diabetes, being overweight, smoking, and asthma. Even if symptoms feel mild, these factors can increase your risk of COVID-19 turning severe. So if you're at high risk and test positive, there are things you can do, like asking your healthcare provider if an authorized oral treatment is right for you. Learn about an option at treatcovid19.com. This message is sponsored by Pfizer.
Mornings were made for better things than rheumatoid arthritis or RA. Xeljanz tofacitinib is a pill for adults with moderate to severe RA when tumor necrosis factor blockers did not work well or could not be tolerated. Xeljanz can help relieve joint pain, swelling, and help stop further joint damage. Xeljanz can lower your ability to fight infections. Don't start if you have one. Before and during treatment, your doctor should check for infections like TB and do blood tests. Serious, sometimes fatal infections, cancers including lymphoma and lung, blood clots, serious heart-related events, tears in the stomach or intestines, and allergic reactions have happened. People 50 and older with heart disease risk factors have an increased risk of death. Tell your doctor if you've had hepatitis B or C, have flu-like symptoms, are prone to infections, or have ever had a heart attack, stroke, clot, or other heart problems, or swelling of lips, tongue, throat, or hives. Ask your doctor about prescription Xeljanz. Visit Xeljanz.com or call 1-844-XELJANZ.
Medical notes this week. A new test could better detect autism in children. Autism is a developmental disability that can greatly benefit from early intervention, but the first hurdle is making a diagnosis. Research published in the journal Neurological Sciences examined the eyes of 36 children already diagnosed with the condition and 24 kids with typical development. By focusing on pupil dilation, scientists were able to show significant differences in the children with autism and those without. The researchers believe this method will improve the accuracy and speed of autism diagnoses. Can air particles cause a heart attack? Researchers in Singapore believe some cases of sudden cardiac arrest have been caused by small particles in air pollution called PM2.5. The paper published in The Lancet Public Health shows clear evidence of a short-term association between these small particles and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. The researchers suggest that the public wear air filtration masks when PM2.5 levels are elevated. A new non-pharmaceutical approach to treating type 2 diabetes. A mouse study in the journal Scientific Reports used a plant called Rhodiola rosea as a natural treatment. The root extract lowered fasting blood sugar levels and improved the body's response to insulin injections. Though more research is needed, scientists say this study showed very promising results. And finally, can grocery shopping actually predict longevity? Researchers seem to think it's one of 17 core predictors, falling under the category of physical function. The study, published in eBiomedicine, wanted to reveal the main causes of a long life. Among the 17 factors, scientists also discovered that a person's smoking habits and cognitive function can influence their lifespan. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Shel Lustig.
You've got advanced prostate cancer, but you're not waiting around. You want straight talk, the facts about Orgovyx.
Orgovyx relugolix, 120 milligram prescription tablets, is a treatment for adults with advanced prostate cancer. Fact, Orgovyx is a different kind of androgen deprivation therapy treatment, a pill, not an injection. Orgovyx may cause serious side effects, including a heart condition called QT prolongation. Tell your doctor right away if you feel dizzy, faint, have a racing or pounding heart, or chest pain. Orgovyx can cause harm to an unborn baby or miscarriage. Use birth control during treatment and for 2 weeks after Orgovyx treatment. The most common side effects include hot flushes, increased blood sugar and blood fat levels, muscle and joint pain, decreased blood hemoglobin levels, increased liver enzymes, tiredness, constipation, and diarrhea. Other side effects include weight gain, decreased sex drive, and erectile function problems. Orgovyx may cause infertility. Talk to your doctor if infertility is a concern for you.
Go with Orgovyx. Ask your doctor. For more facts, visit GoWithTheFacts.com.
And that's Radio Health Journal for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more. And check Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify for a library of past programs. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and information about our guests at RadioHealthJournal.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.